Well, this week, we're continuing a series that I thought would only be a one-unit event on memes. And we'll talk about what memes are, but I'm going to talk to you for just a second about why we're going to continue doing this, or why I've decided to continue doing it. Each week, leading up to and after the first session, I was asking myself, what is the purpose of the memes? How do they work? Do they work? And what is it that we can gain from them? Because it seems as if every time there's a challenge in a culture that forces Christians to think through their faith and forces them into positions of awkwardness, that there is almost inevitably an opportunity for a presentation of the gospel. If there's anything about the name of this class that applies here, it is that paradox. That in those kinds of things where it looks like we're most opposed, that paradoxically we most have the greatest opportunity for a gospel presentation. So as I was going through the memes again this week, thinking, well, am I going to do it again this week or am I going to do something else? I realized that if we go through them and we have a little bit of a system, a way to analyze them, and sort of a three-step process to look at them, that they become a little easier to manage. That when I watched, and I've actually talked to some Christians recently in my own neighborhood about memes, and when they're confronted with them, they're stymied. They just have a visceral reaction. They don't know what to do. And I thought, well, if they had a sort of a protocol or a list of things to just come through in their head, maybe they would see this a different way. And so I'm going to go through that with you, and we're going to try it out a couple of times. And then there will be some new memes, if we have time, because I never finished the list, and I found even more this week. So we'll get through them. For those who haven't been here, we'll give a very brief description of what a meme is, and then we'll move on. So a meme is an image or a statement deemed to be of passing value in cultural discourse. It's usually very short, biting, sometimes cynical. I was looking this week at my new favorite site, the Babylon Bee. If you haven't gone to the Babylon Bee, it's a fake newspaper. It's fake journalism. It's really satirical. You know it's good because CNN and a couple of other places have tried to get it deplatformed. And because they don't like the satire. Because the satire tends to be Christian and tends to not be very politically correct. But as I was looking at that, I was saying, you know, so many of these little stories, these little pretend journalisms are memes. They're saying something very pithy in a very, very biting way. And sometimes they're so funny you have to read them two or three times. So that's, I'm pimping this, I know, it's Babylon Bee. I strongly recommend you look at it. They're a different kind of meme, and if we have a chance some other time, I may even go through some of those, because not only are they hilarious, but they're little gems of truth, and they don't hesitate to poke fun at the Christian church in the places where it really should be, because there are some things that our brothers and sisters do that are just ridiculous. So, a meme, in the context that we're going to be exploring it today, is usually some kind of picture along with a very short comment. Now, this week, as I was trying to figure out how do we go about systematizing the analysis of memes, which sounds a little bit more difficult than it really is, there were three things that I was able to distill out of this, and I spent a lot of hours actually trying to figure this out. What are there in memes that we can get something out of? Well, if we're going to analyze a meme, the first thing we have to find is what claim is that meme making? So in our system, the first part of the process is to figure out what are the claims. We're going to do that today with some of the memes we've already looked at. Then number two, what are the answers to those claims? Because that's the thing that people have the hardest time with, is to figure out, how do I answer this? Now, I would put that very closely to the problem of finding out what the claims are, because sometimes they're so wrapped up in an emotional appeal or cynicism that people just have a hard time emotionally coming up with an answer. Go ahead.
Along with claims, I would say, what are their assumptions? What are they assuming? I mean, it's related to claims, but what's the background assumption in their thinking?
Very good. Thank you. That is good. Yeah. So what are the assumptions in there? Yes. I'm right is the first one. Yeah. Thank you, Nancy. That is correct. What are the assumptions? And what are the assumptions in the claims? The next one is, what are the answers? So as you're looking at a meme, think, okay, what are the assumptions? What is this really saying? What is it claiming? And then how do I answer that? And then the last one is, where in this meme and understanding the difference between the claim and the answer do I find the opening for the gospel? And I'm talking about atheist memes. There are a lot of other ones that have nothing to do with religion at all, they're political or whatever. But we're just focusing on those things that have to do with atheism and the attacks on Christianity, or sometimes, in general, attacks on religion at all. So keep these three things in mind, and we'll subsume assumptions under the claims, because I think that's a wise look at these. So our first one was the one about prayer. We have a picture of some people praying, and it says, prayer, how to do nothing and still think you're helping. So what is or what are the claims and assumptions here? So just think through this yourself for a second. And then I'm going to pop a couple up and see if those don't match what you're saying. So there's a couple of claims at least implicit in this. One of them is that people pray when they should be, quote, doing something. And that, what does that doing something mean? And why would an all-knowing God want your prayers anyway? Can't he figure this out himself? Does he need you to talk to him? Does he need 7.5 billion consultants to be able to tell him what he needs to get done? These seem to be the claims implicit in this. Now, I'm not going to go through the answers with this because we've had a little bit of chance to do that, but let's practice this. We're looking for the claims. These are at least two of them. What's the next thing after the claims? Say it out loud. Answers. Yes, thank you. And then what follows the answer? The gospel opening. What are we looking for? We're looking for the claims. We're looking for the answers. And we're looking for the gospel opening. To make memes useful for us, to see this as a cultural opportunity for evangelism and apologetics, those three things seem to be effective. There's another one on prayer. And for those who can't see it on the screen, it says, if God answers your prayer, he's increasing your faith. If he delays, he's increasing your patience. If he doesn't answer, he has something better for you. And then below it says, confirmation bias. The tendency to search for or interpret information in a way that confirms one's preconceptions, which is characteristic trait of cult mentality. What are the claims? Say it again.
Christianity is a cult.
Christianity is a cult. Interesting. Thank you.
It's really a claim that faith is entirely emotional. That there's no rational tie together in that. It's just emotional need drives the conclusion.
Thank you. Any others? Okay, here are the couple I came up with. The first one is that prayer is untestable. So no matter what you say, if I say I prayed that I would make more money, okay, I didn't make more money, so I'm not going to ever make more money. Let's say that happens. So that just means God's saying, well, you don't need more money. I'm enough. Or any other prayer that you have, one of those three things that they're talking about in there is a confirmation bias. In other words, whatever you look for, you're going to see an answer to prayer. In other words, if you pray and nothing happens, that's an answer to prayer. If you pray and something happens, that's an answer to prayer. Everything I see is confirming that prayer works. So that second one, that first one, prayer is untestable. No matter what happens, you say it works. That's the claim. It's explicit as well as implicit. And then the confirmation bias of prayer is characteristic of a cult mentality. Ross said it's an accusation of that the Christians are in a cult. So these are the claims. You could probably derive more, but these are the two I think that are essential, that if you took one of these out, you would not have the entire statement. So what follows the claim? What are we looking for next? Say it loud.
The answer.
The answer. Thank you. And then once we figure out what the answer is to the claim, what are we looking for?
Gospel.
The gospel opportunity. Thank you. We're starting to get the system now. The next one, the picture of the little child with prosthetic legs, says, since God can't heal amputees, science will. What are the claims implicit here?
God can't heal.
That God can't heal. What else? Thank you. Hope.
That science is separate from God.
That science is separate from God. Thank you. Ross.
I think there's really a claim in that God doesn't exist, because if he did, he would heal. And he would heal.
That there's a claim in this that God doesn't exist, because if he did, he would heal the amputees. Did I get that right, Ross?
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to wait until you put the food in your mouth before I asked you that. Yeah. Yes, sir.
There's also a claim that everyone needs to be whole in order to be productive.
Yes. That's a very good one. An interesting assumption, the claim that everybody has to be whole in order to be bright. Thank you. Peter, they're going to come on the microphone.
There's a claim that God is not as compassionate as people are, that especially scientists are a paragon priestly class, if you will, that are the true good in the world, and that God doesn't represent good.
Thank you. Mark.
Yeah, I think it says God does exist, but he's weak, impotent.
Thank you. There's one way in the back in the corner there. Could you catch that microphone if he threw it to you? We should.
Well, when it says science will heal amputees, that's just assuming a whole lot. I mean, science has accomplished a lot of things, but the conclusion is false too. You know, God can heal amputees, and it's an assumption that science will.
Thank you.
It suggests to me that they're also claiming that science is competing with God, and science is actually doing a better job than God, so we don't need God, even if he does exist.
It makes God unnecessary. Thank you. Let's look at a couple here. Now, these are all good, and they all make sense. And this is exactly the process that we should be going through when we look at these memes. It's, what is this thing saying to us? What are the claims and the assumptions? Here, God is not good, or he's not powerful, because he doesn't heal amputees. We could certainly add the idea that was uttered in the back, that that presumes that you have to, that God, in order for God to be good, everybody has to be well, which is a faulty assumption. And another one is that science succeeds where God fails. Another claim. So what follows this? Well, you've heard some good claims, good inferences from what the meme is saying. What follows from the claim? The answers. What follows from the answer? The gospel opening. Yes. Thank you. Helen, did you have anything that you want to talk about?
God gave us science.
Say again?
God gave us science.
Yes. And that would be perfect and part of the answer. Wouldn't that be something that would be worthwhile in the answer? Where did science come from? Thank you. The next one was a panel, had four little boxes in it. You have some little stick figures talking to each other. In the background is what was obviously a destroyed by a tornado, what looks to me like a bowling alley. And the journalist is asking the victim, "Are you thanking God you weren't killed?" And the victim says, "Would you thank me if I destroyed your community and killed a handful of your friends but decided not to kill you? Do you think I should be thanked for that?" Then the man holding the microphone says, "Well, no, of course not." So the victim says, "So why should I thank God?" Now that's loaded. That's loaded with all sorts of interesting things. But just think about it for a second. I'm gonna be quiet while you think. Here are at least two of the claims. The first one is that God is personally responsible for natural disasters. Do you see that claim implicit in it? And the other one is that thanking God for being saved from a disaster is absurd. That's what the point of the little person is. The victim is saying, why would you thank me if I killed all your friends and left you alive? So what, this one I think would be a particularly interesting one for part three of our three-part response to memes. But let's go through this systematically. Here are the claims, what follows from the claims. The answers, so we develop answers to these claims, which are going to be profound because there's a lot in them. And then after the answers comes what?
The gospel opportunity.
The gospel opportunity, thank you. Now think for just a second how many different ways you could approach a presentation of the gospel in the answers to this question. We could spend an entire day just figuring out different approaches to the gospel presentation, but we won't. The good thing is that each one of you has a personality and an opportunity, and the Holy Spirit works through each one of you uniquely. So there isn't any formula for it. The only formula is that Jesus calls us to present the gospel when we can. The next meme is a little girl holding a Bible, pretty little girl, and she says, or the title says, "God loves you so much that he created hell just in case you don't love him back." Think of the claims here. Warren has one over here. The microphone's coming up on your left.
God is vengeful.
God is vengeful.
And God determines if you go to hell instead of a decision that we make.
Thank you. You can see some predestination, free will, and some other interesting features of this that are going to come up. We have another one?
It's easy to tear down a God you create.
It's easy to tear down a God you create. Yes, thank you.
In line with God is vengeful, it makes God anthropomorphic in being reactive in a jealous way.
So by anthropomorphic, you mean what?
Human, mere human.
We're making a human out of him? Making him
that
human
his love is not unlimited. And
good. Thank you. Hope?
Pinging off what they just said, this is more like the gods of Greek lore, like they're jealous and vengeful and petty and very human.
Yes. The Greek gods were like extensions of humans.
Exactly.
But worse.
They had great power.
Yeah. They were worse because they could do really incredibly awful things.
Yeah.
And did them.
Pretty horrible gods.
Yes. So we came up with, number one, God isn't good. He created hell for people who don't love him. Number two, God does not love you unconditionally. So are those two implicit? Yes, they are. Now, the other ones that you came up with are also implicit. So I'm only giving you a couple. I'm not trying to exhaust it. What I'm trying to do is help you understand the pattern. Ross.
Mark, I see a claim that's common to all of these.
What's that?
And they may not even admit it, but the claim is God exists and I don't like him. I just don't like the idea of being, having to be responsible and that he has that much power and I don't. And these memes are just a cheap way of kicking some sand in his face.
Or stomping their feet or putting their hands on their hips or whatever. And
yeah.
Saying, well, I don't like this God.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. That does seem like an implicit assumption in a lot of it. Yeah, there's a little bit of cattiness to it. So if that's true, Ross, does that help us provide an answer?
Yeah, I think when you talk about needing to wanting at the end of this to have a gospel presentation, we got to start thinking. You know, we have like two reactions to this. Okay, the meme, we read the meme, and we get that slap in the face feeling like, you know, screw you, you're an idiot. You know, that's what we all think, right? But then immediately next, we need to say, how do I love this person back? Not how do I get them back? And that's the trick. That's the hard part. You know, where do we, you know, maybe they do feel that way. Maybe they're angry at God. They don't like the way it is. They feel powerless with him, and they don't like it that he has all that power. Well, you know what? I can understand that. I have moments like that, too, where he doesn't do what I want him to do. Sure. I can understand that. I can relate to it. So can we reach out in a loving, Christ-like way even after we feel that slap that we get when we first read it?
When you're doing that, Ross, are you going from the claim, and in some respects, skipping over the answer and going closer to a gospel or exploiting the gospel opportunity straight away?
I think you have to have that attitude straight away.
Sure. That was my point.
Yeah.
Is that even though I'm giving a system, you know, you've got to have the claims, then understand what the answers are, and then the gospel opportunity. Doesn't mean you can't go to the gospel straight away.
That's right.
If you have the situation that you're describing there. Because some of the times, aren't people, when they write these memes or present them to you in a nasty way, aren't they really crying out for help in some respect?
Sure.
And when they're doing that, isn't the gospel really the answer?
Yes, it is. The gospel with love.
Yes. And that's the crucial feature.
That's the crucial feature.
Yes, yeah, thank you. And I love that that's what you always include in there. Yeah, the gospel with love. Dean, we have a microphone coming in via airmail. No, he's not going to throw it.
Yeah, so gospel with love, I think the name of the class, Paradoxes, should remind us. Sometimes we're offended from some claims in these memes, but then we can remember some of these issues are difficult for us. They're paradoxical, like an all-powerful God, yet a God who has free will beings who love him. And maybe if we look at these claims where people have been hurt or offended themselves, then we can get to the paradox that they're kind of struggling over.
Thank you. I remember months ago, when Ross and I did the series on how do we go about starting and continuing in conversations with people to evangelize them. The one thing that kept coming up over and over and over again was that we have to listen to the person, not just to their arguments. That very often, for example, the question of evil and suffering isn't really an academic question of, well, why does God do that? The question or the issue really is, I'm mad at God because my baby daughter died. And the answer to that person isn't a theological question. It's an interpersonal question. It's how can I now, in a pastoral way, minister to this person who's hurting? First, because nobody else did. Please, in the back.
Yeah, I like what was said earlier, that people basically send themselves to hell. But the new point I have is that I'd like to turn it around a little bit. It's unfalsifiable. It's they can't prove that there's no hell, you know. So they're basically saying hell doesn't exist, but it does.
Thank you. So let me move on to another one here.
Mark.
Yes. Oh, we have, good. Please.
I think the underlying claim here is that there is no God and it's human-made. And these are justification why there is no God.
There's no God and what was the other part?
It's a human
oh, we, make. That we make up a God. Yes.
And these are justification why they don't exist.
Yes, thank you. That definitely could be a claim in this. So what follows the claim?
The answer.
The answer. And then what follows the answer?
The gospel.
The gospel opportunity, gospel presentation. Thank you. Now here's one that really applies to all religions, not just Christianity, but or at least religions that have a bite to them. And it's a picture of drawing of what looks like the typical drawing of Jesus, except this one looks like he's probably on meth or something with his eyes looking that way. What do you mean you're worshiping other gods? I'll have you killed if I can't have you. Now, there's some interesting claims into this, but think about those claims. And if you saw this or somebody presented it to you and said, what do you think? What claims would you think are being made here? Now, I'll give you a couple, because I'm going to move this along. That God kills people for worshiping other gods. That's definitely a claim here, because it says it explicitly. And the other one is that God is irrationally jealous. I'm using the term irrationally with a very particular meaning, because jealousy is not always irrational, depending on how you define jealousy. God even describes himself as a jealous God. Think about that. Go ahead, in the back.
The claim that there are other gods.
That's interesting. Yes, there is a claim that there are other gods. Thank you. Now, did we do this one last time? Some people say yes and some people say no. Okay. Well, then I won't dive into it. There are some others we have that I know absolutely we haven't done. I even brought a Bible because we're going to need it. Think of that, having a Bible in a Christian class. Go ahead.
Just briefly, if you look back in history, you've had people kill others for worshiping other gods. But it wasn't God, it was those people. But there is a historical pattern of people thinking they're acting on behalf of God who are definitely not doing so.
Yes, thank you. And we will be getting into that more later on, because there's another meme in here that goes directly to that point. Thank you. I would love to spend some time on God's jealousy and jealousy in general, but we don't have time. But I do want to let you know that there are at least some definitions of jealousy in which jealousy is not evil. That it can be actually an expression of something that's good, notably love. All right, so we looked at this one last time. It's a picture of what some people would use as a depiction of God, and it says, how dare you do what I already predetermined you would do? What are the assumptions and claims in that one? Say that again? That we have no free will. Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, that it's saying how dare you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. So a couple of the claims that I saw, that was number one, predestination means you have no free will, which is what the young lady said up front here, and that God's judgment on your actions is absurd. How is it that he holds you accountable for what he made you do? Now, both of these are interesting, and so what follows these claims? An answer, yes. So the answer to this is really fascinating, and if it will definitely lead you to step three, which is what? A gospel presentation. Please, Peter.
This is a little less personal. It's more an argument against a paradox that a lot of Christians trip over to fully understand. And it's a wide opening to clarify what Christian doctrine really says and why Christian doctrine describes a transcendent God, because the issue of time and God and predestination versus God's overview of all of the events of history down to the atom with his power, that's the only thing that makes sense. If you're going to make a claim that there is a God who created the universe, he would have to be in this category of power and understanding. But it also opens the door to explain why God's love is so impressive. And this is the most powerful conception of God of any religious faith, and therefore it's the only one that matches what we study. Is right in this paradox, actually. Yes. When you get to time and that element of the Christian faith, it's the only one that ties together rationally. That, so it's a wide open door to explaining this and overcoming the misunderstanding.
Yes, and that would be part of the answer if you wanted to go in that direction. Thank you very much. So this next one has a picture of, somebody said last time it was Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory or something like that. Yeah, I didn't see that show, so I don't know who the people are, but Gene Wilder, okay, I think I understand that. And the text says, the religion your parents taught you as a child is the only true religion, is the one true religion. What a coincidence. This is, in some respects, funny because there is some truth to it. First, it is that people believe their religion is true only because they were raised in it. Notice the word only. And religious belief is merely cultural. And notice the word merely. So if these are the claims, what would we be doing next? Coming up with answers. And after we've come up with the answers, what will we do next? We look for a gospel opportunity. There we go. Now, this panel has a depiction of, I guess, somebody who's supposed to be God. And it says, reasons to believe in God as a checklist. It says, proof of events. And these are all lined out as not being reasons to believe in God. Proof of events, historical evidence, credible testimony, logical reasoning, etc. So as you go down the list, only one of these reasons to believe in God is checked, and that is blind faith. Now, remember us talking about this last time, so I'll get straight away to the claims, in that the claim is that belief in God is merely blind faith, and we know that's explicit because that's the only check box, so that makes it easy. We know what the claim is there. And there are no rational, historical, or evidentiary bases for belief in God. So when you go down the list, these are exactly the things that the list claims we do not have. Historical or other evidentiary bases for our faith. This is ripe for the second part of our three-part process, which is what? Answers, followed by a gospel presentation. Thank you. Then we had this long one where this writer says, when you consider that God could have commanded anything he wanted, anything, the Ten Commandments have got to rank as one of the great missed moral opportunities of all time. How different history would it have been had he clearly, unmistakably forbidden war, tyranny, taking over other people's countries, slavery, exploitation of workers, cruelty to children, et cetera, et cetera. Her, yeah. Yeah, so you could tell she was a writer because we had a lot of stuff there. The claims are, at least, that the Ten Commandments lack crucial prohibitions. So her first thing is to impugn the Ten Commandments. And the second thing is that the Bible does not prohibit tyranny, slavery, exploitation of workers, treating others as inferior beings, etc. Please, we have one person in the back.
She seems to be claiming that if the Bible had prohibited those things, people would have behaved differently.
She does seem to say that. That is one of the assumptions that appears to be in that. Thank you. Go ahead, Russ.
He does explicitly claim, he says we're supposed to love each other. And if we did, none of those things would happen. So she's just wrong on the face of it.
She is wrong, especially as applied. So the love doctrine, as applied, would cover all of these things. Yes. Her critique was that there weren't more set apart statutes. In other words, it wasn't more statutorily explicit. But if you remember last time we went through at least part of this, there are some of these things. Let me go back here. I don't want to go too deep into the answers because we want to get into some more stuff. But does the Bible clearly, explicitly state that slavery is wrong?
Yes.
It does. It does. Now, where people get, I'm going into the answers here, and I really don't want to go too deep into this, but in the places where slavery is depicted in the Bible, in some places it's depicted as wrong on its face, that people were enslaved, that they were oppressed, that they were treated badly, they were dehumanized, all the terms you want to use for something evil. It was explicitly recognized that way. But then you look at some of the critiques of Christianity, particularly Paul saying, you know, if you're a slave, then be a good slave. As if Paul is endorsing slavery. But that is not at all what Paul is doing. If you look at Paul's letters, when he's talking about situations that are cultural, he talks about, here we are, how do we live in this culture now that we are following Christ? He's not saying, I think it's a good thing that slavery is there. Because what's Paul going to do? Say, stop. Go ban slavery and let's just fight against it. It's not going to work. He could not possibly do that. He says, all right, we're slaves, and he even uses it as we're slaves of Christ. So when you look at the different, and there are many, many more places in the Bible. I was looking in, I think it was Deuteronomy, or may have been Deuteronomy, yesterday, and it explicitly tells the Jews that if people from other lands come into their lands and those people are slaves, that they're not to be treated as slaves, that they're to be given liberty. So the very God of Israel is explicitly telling the Israelites, do not harbor slaves. Bring everybody in and liberate them. So that's just one of the many answers to be given to this. So there are other things in here, that exploitation of children, wife beating, treating women or anyone as chattel or inferior beings. When you go into the Old Testament, you have the same problem over and over again. You're looking at what was going on in the culture and not looking at what God says culture should be. So much of what the Old Testament does is record events rather than recording the morals of those events. But where it does record the moral of the events, God says, do not mistreat your wife, your child, or anybody else.
Well, I was way back on slavery.
Okay.
Heard Dennis Prager
keep on going.
He said that don't steal means also don't steal people.
That's right.
Don't steal their life away from them.
Yes. And there's an explicit prohibition against that in the Old Testament.
Right. It's in the Ten Commandments.
Well, it's explicit in the Old Testament about not taking people and stealing them, to not kidnap. Yes, to make slaves out of them. And there were exceptions to that, but that was not allowing the people to do it. It was when God gave them explicit commands for a very particular reason. which opens up another can of worms. So this one says, believers do good things out of fear of death and hell with the expectation of great reward, and atheists do the right thing because it's the human thing to do. So we talked about this last time, and it was interesting because you all went to answers really quickly, and I was proud of you for doing that so fast. And there was a lot of emotion involved in this. So do we only do what we do if we're believers because we're afraid of death and hell? Well, the answer is of course not. And we even talked about the people in this class, that the folks in this class minister to each other, love each other, and do things not because they're afraid of going to hell if they don't, but because they love each other. Atheists do the right thing without such fear. They do, quote, what's human, whatever that means. And the interesting part about that is if being human is what determines what's right and wrong, then what do you do with 7.5 billion people who have a different idea? And they're all humans. That's the problem. You have these 7.5 different versions of morality, and they're all, quote, being human. To superimpose a belief on a group and to say, well, that's not moral and this is just human, is to presuppose that you have a privileged position. Where is the basis for that? There's part of the answer. And that's also the opening to the gospel presentation. Go ahead in the back.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's many different views. But in Christianity, the human thing to do is, the natural thing to do is to sin. It's not to do the right thing.
That's true. And what they're getting at here on this panel is that for the, quote, sophisticated atheist, that there is a right and wrong, but you don't need God to have it. And that it's just the right thing to do. Well, where do you get this right thing to do, and what makes your right right? What do you mean by right anyway? So there ends up being some circularity to it and some trivial statements that when you pry into it, it's a really interesting answer that backs them into a wall, a very tough wall for them to get back from. Go ahead.
Have they forgotten the death camps? Have they forgotten the Nazis and the communists, all who were atheists? Did they do the right thing, the human thing? They did the human thing, but do they do the right thing?
Yeah, no, they didn't do the right thing. And I think if you were to interview many of the people who governed those death camps, and I have seen some of those interviews, they're chilling. They're really, really scary to watch. And I remember one in particular, he was asked, and I think this was in either Peru or Chile where he did this. No, it was in Italy, where he killed a few hundred innocent people, just rounded them up and killed them in retribution because some of the partisans had killed some of the soldiers. And he was asked, do you think there was anything wrong with that? And he said, no, that's just the way we did things. And he was completely, completely at ease with that. It was just it's just a human thing to do. They killed our soldiers. We couldn't find out who did it. So we'll just round up some of their fellow people out of their village and we'll kill them and that'll stop it. That's just the human thing to do. That was his words. It's fascinating. I'm an aficionado of World War II history, and I'm particularly interested in what went on in those camps and how did so much evil come through a country that had previously been a Christian country. You know, Martin Luther, that was where Martin Luther started the Reformation. So the human thing to do isn't always the right thing to do, and it's part of the answer. Please, in the back.
We know as believers that it says in the Word that we are freed from the law of sin and death when we come into faith in Christ. And so we are doing our good works, not to earn our salvation, but we are doing them because the Holy Spirit has come in and changed our desires. And such wonderful demonstrations. I mean, I was thinking of the, was it the Mennonite group that someone came in and murdered, and then in the school or whatever it was, you know what I'm talking about. But anyway, lots of examples of that, and the forgiveness, you know, that came out, which is in total contradiction of the rest of the world, and evidence of that change in the human heart that God brings about, which our good works come out of, and not in any way to earn our salvation, but in thankfulness for that.
Thank you. It's not the human way. It's a supernatural way. Amen. Thank you. Was there another one over here? No? Okay. I'll get moving on to the next one here. So we had the answers. What would follow the answer? The gospel presentation. Keep the process going. You're probably wondering, when's Mark going to quit talking like that? When we're done. Because I want you to leave out of here at least understanding this three-part process, because if you invoke it, it'll work. Go ahead.
Well, Dawkins is so absurd, but his worldview is backed into a Planck microsecond from the origin event. And everything after that Planck microsecond, the Bible models quite well, and his model doesn't.
So are you referring to the current slide that's up that says, I'm against religion, because it teaches us to be satisfied with not understanding the world?
Right. He's the one that doesn't understand the world. He's in denial about all the discovery that's come about that throws his worldview down into the dust. And they're still living in, you know, biology stuck on never applying math stubbornly, or physics where their last refuge is in that tiny microsecond that they can't penetrate. And they can make up anything they want about that.
Thank you. So the claims that he's making here is, number one, religion encourages ignorance. And the second one is that religion should be opposed. Richard Dawkins is an ardent opponent of any religion. And of course, Christianity is his favorite because it's so accessible to him, and pretty easy to beat up, because there are a lot of people who are in the media who represent, quote, Christianity, who do an awful job of it. So they're pretty easy to point fingers to. So he's basically beating up a straw man. So if we were to have these claims, we would be looking for the answers, and after the answers, the opportunity for the gospel presentation. And this one, we don't have any claims here. This is just kind of cute that this atheist cat is talking about, where's your dog now, as the atheist cat reads Richard Dawkins' The Dog Delusion, which is a variant of the God Delusion that Richard Dawkins actually did write. So this panel says, you don't need religion to have morals. If you can't determine right from wrong, then you lack empathy, not religion. So what are the claims here? We'll make it easy on you here. First, that religion is not the source of morals. Religion is not the source of morals, because you don't need religion to have morals. It says it right explicitly. What is the source of morals? Empathy. That's kind of bizarre, but that's very much like the claim that you don't need religion, you just need to make your decisions because it's the human thing to do. Warren.
And he's implying that empathy comes with humanity, and it doesn't necessarily.
No, it happens. Thank you. As an answer to this, it would be very easy to show that there are a lot of non-empathetic people. And a lot of those non-empathetic people make their morals out of a lack of empathy. Utilitarianism has nothing to do with empathy, but that's a moral code. Then our good friend,
Mark,
the late Christopher Hitchens, had a panel that says, since it's obviously inconceivable that all religions can be right, the most reasonable conclusion is that they're all wrong. Now, this almost could be, instead of an atheist meme, this could almost be very well a Christian meme, because it's such a stupid statement. Really, I didn't even think about that until very late last night. I looked at it and I said, wow, I could see this on a Christian website, because is it logically correct? No, it's not. It doesn't follow. It doesn't follow that because they can't be right, they can't all be correct, that they are necessarily all wrong. Is it possible that one could be correct and the rest of them are wrong? Yes. And so, I mean, this is even syllogistic logic would solve that problem. Yes.
Yeah, from his statement, being a teacher, if I have a multiple choice question, if three answers are wrong, the fourth one obviously is wrong.
That's exactly how it would apply here. You definitely got that. So the claim is pretty stupid, but this is an emotional appeal. And what he's saying is, since all religions can't be right, and none are, being non-religious is therefore most reasonable. That's really what he's getting at. It's a stupid one, but it's nevertheless a claim. And it does give us an opportunity for an answer to show how stupid it is, because it really is stupid. I don't know, use that word lightly here. It's thoughtless. It doesn't have any kind of real depth to it, and it's literally illogical. And therefore, when we come up with our answer and follow it with our gospel presentation, we're answering the question, is being non-religious the most reasonable option? And the gospel presentation gives us the opportunity to do two things, to provide an answer, and then also to provide the gospel. Now, this one's kind of hard to see, so I'll say it. It's a picture of what looks like kind of a disc with some slits in it around the edges, waterfalls coming off. It's a flat earth. And it says, at the time Genesis was written, it was believed that the earth was flat. If they couldn't even get the shape of our planet right, what are the odds for them nailing the creation of everything then? In other words, if they were too stupid to figure out that the earth wasn't flat, then why should we listen to them? They did have the circumference figured out. They had all sorts of interesting things figured out. No, they didn't. And there were so many things that were figured out about the sphericity of the earth. Even there's Old Testament verses about the cyclones circling around the earth as a circle. So, or as a sphere, not just a circle, because a flat earth could be a circular flat earth. But the claim here is that the author of Genesis believed the earth was flat. As an answer, we all will say right up front, no, actually that's not true. And Genesis is therefore unreliable. Well, if the first part's false, then the conclusion's going to be false, or could be false. It isn't necessarily true that, even if they believed the earth was flat, that Genesis would therefore be unreliable. The author of anything in the Bible, all of them are fallible. It's when they're inspired by God to write something that their products become infallible in that particular situation. So this one's pretty easy to give an answer to. Number one, the author of Genesis did not believe the earth was flat. And number two, therefore, it's not the case that Genesis is unreliable for that reason. That's important, for that reason, because there may be other reasons that they could say Genesis is unreliable. So here's a picture or a drawing of a bunch of people drowning. Noah's Ark is right next door to them. And it says, if you get your morals from a fictional monster who drowned his own children, you should really just shut up. Nice, huh? So the claims here are that the God of Noah's flood is a fictional monster, and followers of that God are not worth listening to. Ross.
All of these ones that talk about morals and how atheists have better morals than us. Well, if those atheists are from the West, their morals are from Christianity and from the Bible. They just don't think about it that way.
Thank you. So in this one, the answer is pretty straightforward. The God of Noah's flood isn't a fictional monster, and followers of those God are therefore not necessarily worth listening to, but they're not worth ignoring because they're not following a fictional God, fictional monster. So the answers to that are pretty straightforward. And of course, this once they start talking about anything out of the Bible, that's an automatic opening to the to a gospel presentation. Just, oh, well, we want to talk about the Bible. What does Noah's flood have to do with Jesus? Boom. You just now got a gospel presentation. And here's a little funny one where Noah's there with the animals and it's kind of flooding and it says, well, maybe I shouldn't have brought the termites. No claims on this one. This one's just for fun. And then this one where Jesus is standing next to a Honda Accord and it says, Jesus drove a Honda but refused to talk about it. And then he quotes John 12:49 and says, for I did not speak of my own accord. Yes, it's nice that somebody who knew the Bible would put this in here. I was talking to another Christian and he says, well, you know, there's a better one. I said, really, there's a better one than that? He says, well, remember that the disciples got together and they were all in one accord. I said, oh, that would be fun to see a depiction of that one. And then the last little funny bit here is that technically Moses was the first person with a tablet downloading data from the cloud. You know, that could only be somebody from the 21st century come up with something like that. You have to lighten this up a little bit. And then the last funny one is, following a major incident in the Garden of Eden, news broadcasters interview a key suspect who denies everything, with a microphone in the face of a snake. Some of these are just too cute to ignore. Pardon me? It probably was. It probably was. Some of these are just, it's okay to make fun of yourself. Now back to something a little bit more serious. So this meme has a globe in the hand of what's supposed to be, the hand of God. And it says, ever notice how God never does anything to atheists who dismiss, insult, and blaspheme him? It's almost like he doesn't exist. So what are the claims here? Well, the claims are that nothing happens to atheist blasphemers, and therefore God does not exist. Or, better put, nothing happens to atheist blasphemers and God does not exist. Go ahead.
That if God did exist, he would be vindictive.
Thank you. So it would actually be an assumption, wouldn't it? That this assumes that God should be vindictive if he existed. We have the answer to that, that he's not, but does that not perfectly open up a gospel presentation? I mean, God's not vindictive, what is he? He's just, loving, omniscient, and how do these express in Jesus? You talk about just a door kicked open for us for a gospel presentation, this is it. This insulting thing is an opening for a gospel presentation. We just have to see it that way. And of course, here are two different versions of the way to look at the world. Stephen Hawking says, heaven is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. And John Lennox says, atheism is a fairy story for those afraid of the light. Two very interesting ways of looking at the world. Now, you could make something out of that. I didn't. But you could look at the claims of both of these and then see what would the answers be and how would you go about making a gospel presentation of that. John Lennox makes it real easy. Now here is one that this one is probably one that comes up the most, or I should say comes up often, among the most sophisticated atheists. Because the most sophisticated atheists have actually read the Bible. And they'll throw things from the Bible at you, and you'll have to step back and say, well, what do I do? Because they're right. But now let's find out, is this correct? So in Ezekiel 9:6 is what they're quoting. It says, and let me describe this for the people who cannot see this. There's a man who's got this shocked look on his face, and above it it says, when you realize that God commands serial killing, then you see this shocked look. And then it quotes Ezekiel 9:6, slaughter the old men, the young men and women, the mothers and children, but do not touch anyone who has the mark. Begin at my sanctuary. So they began with the old men who were in front of the temple. Now, what is the answer to this? Let me get Ezekiel here. All right, we don't have a lot of time, so I don't know if I'm going to get through all of this. But let me put it to you this way. If you look at Ezekiel 9:6, what he's quoting here isn't God commanding the death of all of these people. What he's doing is he's quoting a vision that Ezekiel had. And I went back and I looked at this, because I know there are places in the Bible where God commands the wholesale slaughter of a city. But this isn't it. This, whoever did this read the Bible but didn't read the Bible. So they read the text and didn't get the fact that if you start with Ezekiel 8 and you work your way all the way through, you'll see that this is a vision that Ezekiel was given. But this is not actually what God did at that time. But are there times where God has actually done that, where he has told people to destroy anybody? So let me look here. So we know that in 2 Samuel, God told Saul to destroy the Amalekites. He said, go up there, kill their cattle, kill their animals, kill their babies, kill their children, kill the women, kill the men, and destroy everything and burn it to the ground. Destroy everything. Wipe it from the face of the earth. Now that is a command from God to Saul through a prophet. Now if he had quoted this, that would be a bigger problem. Unfortunately for the person who did this, they were ignorant of the Bible. They were quoting a vision instead of an actual act. So let's use the platinum rule of apologetics and give our opponent the very best argument they could have. Let's actually work from the real truth that God actually did tell Saul to wipe out the Amalekites. Children, adults, everyone. All the creatures and everything. Why? Why? Go ahead.
I just wanted to make the point that you mentioned that we need to listen to people when they say things like this. And when you look at all of these collectively, there is so much hurt and there is so much anger behind these statements. I think we need to really work hard to get in touch with that hurt.
Yes.
And get in touch with that anger and not be blinded by all the other stuff.
Yes, thank you. And you know what, that's a beautiful way of moving into the answer to this. And we won't have time to get into the answer fully. But part of the answer is the answer to the question, why did God tell Saul to wipe out an entire group? It sounds so vicious. I mean, children, they don't know what's going on. The animals, you know, they haven't been doing any kind of prophesying, or they're not the ones going out and starting wars. What is it about these people that God was so angry about that he wanted to make sure they could never do it again? Was it an act of viciousness, or in some respects, was it an act of love? Go ahead.
Well, Hugh Ross has described that. He said that it's like a surgeon who has to cut out cancerous cells, just eradicate totally this whole mass, get rid of it, because, and these people were so ill, I mean, they were just so evil that their evil infected everything, and they had to be removed from the body totally.
Yes.
In order to save the body.
The Amalekites were more vicious and horrible than probably most of the people in this class or people watching this know. One of the things that the Amalekites did, you know, the Amalekites were the ones, one of the people, who raided Israel when they were trying to get out of, during the Exodus. So the Israelites are just trying to get out. They're just minding their own business. We're done with these people. We're trying to go to the promised land. And for no good reason, the Amalekites come and they just cause absolute havoc, killing and doing all sorts of things to the Israelites. But that's not it. That's not the entire thing. The Amalekites made it as a hobby to torture people. They did it like a hobby. They burned their own children. They did all sorts of horrible, horrible things within their own culture. I mean, to themselves and among themselves. And so this was a reprobate group. So everything was affected by their reprobation. Their animals would be affected by it too. If you've ever been to a place where the animals are being tormented by the people who own them, the animals don't act right. And if you've ever seen anybody adopt a pet that's been beaten or misused, it takes a long time for them to get over it. And sometimes they just don't. They're not, if they were animals that you were going to use in a farm, you wouldn't be able to use them. They would constantly be rebelling and trying to fight with you. The children had seen how their parents behaved generation after generation after generation. They grew up believing this was the right way to live, that you just tortured people, that you killed your brothers and sisters, that you might be the next one. So you can say, well, what about a two-year-old? They don't know anything, or the really little babies. You could say, yeah, that's true. For whatever reason, God wanted them to be extinguished at that time and not have to grow up from being parented by the adults. God is the ultimate arbiter. And remember, this was not God telling Saul, from now on, just be a genocidal maniac. He was not doing that. So one of the things that is constantly used against Christianity is that Christianity and Judaism are genocidal religions, or are a genocidal religion. And the truth is, God said, no, you will not do that. But when there is a time to do it, only under my command will you do it, and only as I have told you to do it, and not any differently. So there were times where he said, you wipe everybody out? And he said, no, there's some times where you wipe some people out. But every single time it was to prevent something that God knew, if it weren't done, it would cause even more damage later. And as it turned out, Saul didn't wipe everybody out and didn't do everything he was supposed to do, and the Amalekites still caused them problems. So Saul's refusal to obey God and do everything he was told to do in that actually did cause the problems that God was trying to stop by wiping them out. That's not genocide. That's cancer surgery. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, it's a difficult sell, but for us in this room, we have to understand that that is the truth. And the reality is that when we look at human nature and realize how reprobate people can become if they're allowed full expression of their sin, that's what they will come to. And there isn't a culture that was allowed that full expression that didn't have some version of that. It wasn't until they got big enough that they realized, oh, we're killing ourselves. But even some very, very big cultures ended up destroying themselves by their evil, their wickedness like this. So God protects the world, and especially back then, by destroying them or having others destroy them for him.
Yeah, because the ideas of the Amalekites were dangerous. And, you know, they could creep, and they did creep in to Israel, and intermarriage is always a danger, you know, was a danger there because they were so wicked.
Yes.
Yeah.
the answers to these problems, especially one this difficult, is that you have to know the history of the events going on in order to make sense of them. If you didn't, you just look at that and you say, sure he might have done that, but maybe it means something else. No, it doesn't mean anything else. It means exactly what it says. It was too particular to be a legend. So now the question is, who were these Amalekites? Why did God want to get rid of them? And so forth. So it forces us, when we come up with the answers, to dig deeply, which is why I really loved this one, because it forced me to go back into the Old Testament and to find out, who were these Amalekites? Why would God want to wipe these people out? And what does Ezekiel think? You know, they blew this one, you know, whoever put this in there. This wasn't really a good, strong claim. We have a better claim, and yet we have an answer to that. We're out of time. So with this, I'm going to leave us with this final thing. We have three elements to a response when we see memes. What's the first one? We're looking for the claims. And then after we see what the claims are, what do we look for? The answers. And once we see the answers, what do we look for? The gospel presentation. If you leave today and you remember nothing else but those three things, praise God. I will have achieved my mission for the day. So with that, let me close us in prayer, and then we can go on our week. Lord, thank you so much for bringing us before you, to let us see your word, to let us see how other people who don't know you behave and how we are to respond to them. Lord, give us wise minds and loving hearts in dealing with people who don't love you, because you want us to do that and we want to do that for you. Help us, Lord, to be ready at all times to give a gospel presentation, however meekly or however strongly we do it, for the Holy Spirit is the one who changes people's hearts, not our words. But let us be ready with our words, for you've called us to do that. Thank you, Lord. We love you. Please bless everyone in this room and make them loving servants. Amen. Thank you all very much.
Yes, sir.